The following talk was given at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on April 10, 2019. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Before we started this current series of talks given by individual students for Open Wednesdays, we were going through the book Appreciate Your Life by Maizumi Roshi. He was both a Rinzai and a Soto Zen master, so some of the things he said in this book made me want to respond, nonetheless, I find it frequently helpful to study other Zen teachers besides Norm and Steve. Sometimes they will say essentially the same thing that Norm and Steve are saying, but in a slightly different way, and it will spark a fresh insight. And the chapter that did it the most for me was Maizumi's chapter on thusness. Some of it also made me want to respond, what? Because he quotes Dogen extensively on thusness, and Dogen frequently makes me feel that way. He starts with a quote from Dogen's Shobogenzo Emu. Great Master Kokaku of Mount Ungan was the rightful heir of Tozan. He was the 39th Dharma descendant of Shakyamuni Buddha and the rightful ancestor of the Tozan tradition. One day he addressed the assembly saying, "If one wants to attain the essence of thusness, one must become a person of thusness. But one is already a person of thusness, so why should one be anxious about the essence of thusness?" Then Maizumi says, "The essence of thusness is enlightenment." Dogen Jinzi says, Zenji says, "It is said that to think of attaining the essence of thusness is already to be a person of thusness. But one is already a person of thusness, so why should one be anxious about the essence of thusness?" Which is to say that the as-it-is-ness is supreme enlightenment, and that is what we call thusness. Thusness is no other than this very body and mind. How do you appreciate this? Dogen Zenji first expressed thusness in Chinese and then in Japanese. When we examine this line in Chinese, it means to want or to wish for enlightenment. If one wants to attain the essence of thusness, one must become a person of thusness. But Dogen Zenji rephrases it in Japanese in the following way. To think of attaining the essence of thusness is already to be a person of thusness. Dogen Zenji says, "You are already thusness." The Nirvana Sutra says that all beings have Tathagata Buddha's wisdom and virtue. How do we manifest or reveal ourselves as having the same wisdom as Tathagata Buddha, or reveal ourselves as the person of thusness? This is always the key to our practice. Whether your practice is shikantaza, koans, breathing, or something else, how do you understand this poem? Having the life we are living, we are already the person of thusness, the unsurpassable way. Are we truly living as such a person? Then he quotes Dogen again. The nature of this supreme enlightenment is such that even the universe in all the 10 directions is but a small portion of the supreme enlightenment. And the supreme enlightenment is still further beyond the entire universe. We are also various furnishings in the universe in all 10 directions. How do we know such is the case? The answer is, we know that such is the case because our bodies and minds manifest themselves in the entire universe, and they are all selfless. So this is Maizumi again. They are all selfless. In other words, with I and without I, including both relative and absolute. These 10 directions, the entire world, are nothing but the body and mind of the person of thusness. The entire universe is nothing but each and every one of us. And at the same time, such a person is selfless. And being selfless, the person is able to manifest body and mind as the 10 directions, as the entire universe. Here is the expression. There is the expression, the world in the 10 directions is nothing but the illumination of one's self. So how to be this selfless person? We are already this person. What is preventing us from realizing it? So then this next part is quoting Dogen again. Our bodies are not really ours. Life passes with time, never stopping for a moment. Where did our ruddy faces disappear to? Although we look for them, their traces are nowhere. As we observe carefully, there are many things in the past we can no longer find. Neither do our sincere minds ever stand still. They go and come at every turn. Even though we have the mind of sincerity, it is not something sluggish surrounding the self. Within this context, there are people who arouse the mind all of a sudden. Once the mind is aroused, they discard things they have hitherto indulged in, they desire to hear what they have not yet heard, and seek to verify what they have not yet verified. All this has nothing to do with their personal efforts. We must know that this is so because they are persons of thusness. How do we know they are persons of thusness? We know they are persons of thusness because they think of attaining the essence of thusness. Does everyone but me find this helpful? To me, it just goes round and round, doubling back on itself. I'm sure there's wisdom in it, like the wisdom in Katagiri's, you are the entire universe. But you're not the entire universe, you're just you. But you're not just you, you're the entire universe. But you're not the entire universe, you're just you. Remember that story? As Maizumi puts it, with I and without I, including both relative and absolute. Let me come back to that. The way my mind works, I want to know what to do. Let's go back to one of the first pieces Dogen wrote, the Fukan Sasenki, where he says, if you want to attain suchness, you should practice suchness without delay. What does that look like? I'm sure Norm would say, resume the practice of awareness. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. All very well and good for meditation.
Grasp an idea of awareness.
Right. But how does this help me deal with the problem areas in my life? There are people in my life who, whether they do it deliberately or unwittingly, really push my buttons. Or to take more responsibility, I allow my buttons to get pushed. I maintain the view that they really ought to know how to behave better. So the key for me in the passage I just read to you was when Maizumi rephrased thusness into as it isness. There was something about the change of wording that allowed me to see what I had been doing. I know that the sources of dukkha are desire, aversion, and delusion, wanting what I think is good that I don't think I have enough of, not wanting what I think is bad that I think I have too much of, thinking I am separate from everything else, everybody else, that I am in here and everything and everybody else is out there. In Steve's first book, he ended with the leaning mind. Leaning toward or away from. So I knew all this. But what I had done was carve out an exception for myself because some people really ought to know how to behave better. But I'm here tonight to say, as it isness doesn't have any exceptions. How can that be? With the crises in the world today, global climate change, the current political climate, how can we accept the status quo? Well, we do what we can to, quote, take care of the situation. we find ourselves in, whatever that looks like, given the particular situation. But practicing suchness is job one. So let's go back to the people who really ought to know how to behave better. Maybe they should, but they just don't pull it off all the time. The as-it-is-ness phrase allowed me to relax my grip on that. I can let them behave the way they're going to behave. My problem came from seeing them as separate from me and judging them harshly. When I let go of that, when I let them behave however they are going to behave, I experience peace. Wow. As I go about interacting with these problematic people in my life, or people I have allowed to become problematic on a relative level, I can analyze how my buttons get pushed and prepare myself to react differently or not at all in similar circumstances, which will inevitably come around again, taking care of the situation. Changing that other person? Not my job. Doesn't work to try. Direct confrontation generally just gets their backs up. The way for me to practice thusness is to watch my own mind, to look for when I am carving out an area it is okay for me to be judgmental about, or mad about, or greedy about, or whatever klesha is up at the moment. Like the nun who took the vows to uphold the, 311 precepts, I just have to watch my mind. Cat vomit. Who likes that? The way cats groom themselves involves ingesting a lot of indigestible cat hair, and the way cats take care of that problem is by coughing up hairballs. We can do a few things to forestall some of the hairballs, like grooming them with a comb or a wet hand, or feeding them hairball control treats. But you know, hairballs are going to happen, and we just have to clean them up when they do. Mary and I appreciate our cats. They add so much delight to our lives that to focus on the unpleasantness of cat vomit, stepping in it in the dark, having to get the stains out of whatever they happen to be on whenever they got the urge, we realize we can't carve that out. Politics. I think the current administration of our government is a travesty. The man I work with every day thinks the opposite. We have realized that to work together as a team, we cannot allow ourselves to talk politics, so we don't. I would not be able to change his mind. He already believes what he hears on Fox, so I don't try. We are actually both kind of proud of ourselves for managing to pull it off. I like to think I'm good for him. He's got 17 years of work experience in our field, but I've got over twice as much. He tends to get mad when things don't go smoothly, and I'm better able to keep calm and in such situations and work things out. I know he's good for me. He's way more safety conscious than I am, and you have to be safety conscious in the construction trades, especially if you're working with other people. But by and large, that's not one of the problem areas in my life, though it can always develop into one. Recently, we got split up for several weeks, and he got used to working by himself. And then when we got put back working with each other again, he would bark at me, "You're in my way!" every time I didn't jump out of it fast enough. I managed to keep my cool, but the next day I said, "I enjoy working with you when we can do it collaboratively, but if it's going to be like yesterday, I'm done." Of course, he got all defensive, which kept him from hearing the first part of what I said. I had to repeat it. But the fact that we had developed some camaraderie and teamship already got us over the hump, definitely mitigated the confrontation. Back to as-it-is-ness. Should I have just let his new way of working become habitual? I took a chance, and that time it worked out. A few days ago, our boss was mad at me for something I didn't think was my fault as much as he seemed to think it was. And the more I thought about it, the madder I got myself, until I made up my mind to stop by the shop on the way home and have it out with him. But I managed to restrain myself and reconsider, and I decided it was still too soon. We were both too mad, and nothing good would come of it. Several days later, after another co-worker had told me about the boss being on his back as well, this boss came out of his office to say that he would be out of town for the next few days because after his parents-in-law had died, his sister-in-law had decided to live on the family farm on the banks of the Red River of the North outside of Fargo. She had never had to deal with spring flood before and was in full panic mode, but refused to leave. He didn't think it should be his problem, but in order to keep peace in his house, he was going to have to go up there. He's still there, I think. At that point, he and his wife were only able to communicate by texting each other. I suppose she thought that since he'd always gone up to help her parents during spring floods, why wouldn't he help her sister? I suppose he thought that things are different now that he's part owner of the company and has more responsibility. So, not every problem requires an immediate solution. Sometimes it's not even possible. When a neighboring king decided to invade the Buddha's homeland, the Buddha went out to the side of the road where the king and his army would pass by and sat meditation under a tree with no leaves. It was a strange sight. "Why wouldn't you sit in the shade?" the king asked. The Buddha explained that the love of his homeland made it possible. The king was touched and turned around. But, back home, his advisors managed to talk him into the invasion again. The Buddha and his monks found themselves watching the battle from a nearby hill. The monks wanted him to intervene again, but by that point there was nothing to be done. I suspect that that story is apocryphal. I suspect the Buddha was not all that full of love for homeland. But what do I know? I wasn't there. It's a story to make a point. Once a battle is started, it's hard to stop. But if I am one of the combatants, if my job is to watch my own mind, on guard to notice when I have slipped away from pure awareness, and to let go of that thought or emotion that is clouding what I see in the present moment, and the sooner the better, it's definitely harder once I'm in full flight or fight mode. Or is it the other way around? But it can be done. The sooner it is, the less damage will be done. Why should I give myself a free pass to express it once I have gotten angry? Anger shows up. Now take care of it. As if it were a crying baby, as Thich Nhat Hanh used to say. That is how to be a person of thusness when anger has arisen. Don't identify with it. Take care of it. Will I be able to pull this off? I don't know. Anger has been coming up for me a lot lately, and I have not always responded well at all. Anger and judgment seem to be linked for me. I have been aware of a personal predilection for being judgmental, a habitual inclination. My mother was judgmental, and I caught the brunt of some of it, so I can blame her. Now that she's 90, she is less judgmental. I want to work to let go of it so I don't have to wait until I'm 90. The anger is newer. I'm not used to losing it like I have in the last few years. Perhaps it is because I am being less judgmental about myself and therefore less depressed. But they both keep coming back, being judgmental and getting angry. My job is to notice as soon as possible, to not identify with them, to take care of them, to let go of them as often as necessary. And now I have this newfound key. I already knew about it, but I rediscovered it, this new personal policy of as-it-isness, and of watching my own mind for when I'm slipping away from that. And I managed to make it to about 20 minutes. That's pretty good for me. So that's the end of my prepared talks, and given the weather, we might want to go home sooner rather than later, but I had said earlier in the talk something about coming back to absolute and relative. So in a non-prepared way, I've been reading this book by Ben Connolly, Inside Yogacara, Vasubandhu's Yogacara. And I'm only halfway through it. But he, his central premise for the book is that Vasubandhu's first half of the 30 verses were on the Abhidharma, and the second half of the 30 verses were on the Mahayana teachings that he got from his brother, Asanga. He was an expert in the Abhidharma, and his brother converted him late in life. But Ben Connolly says he thinks that Vasubandhu was actually merging the two or finding good things in both of them. And I find that fascinating. So my talk today was kind of my version of the first half of the 30 verses. Not specifically at all. There's a lot in there about the storehouse and the seeds in the storehouse and nourishing beneficial seeds and watching out for the bad ones and like that. So I didn't talk about any of that, but I didn't talk anything about, really, about emptiness either. And if I'd managed to finish the book in time and thoroughly absorbed it, this might have been a very different talk. I don't know. However, it's interesting to me to, well, his central premise that that we need both. Norm used to say we live at the intersection of relative and absolute. And he doesn't say that anymore, and I never have got out from him why he doesn't say that anymore. But I haven't ever asked him that directly, and I should have. And I thought about it, but I was sick, and so it didn't happen. Well, I will ask you sooner or later. But I think it would be easy in Zen to put too much emphasis on the absolute and not enough on the relative, because we live at that intersection, to accord with absolute. Is it Sandokai? To accord with absolute is still not enlightenment. So we could talk about that, or we could talk about anything now. Yeah.
So would you be willing to share a little more about what it is that taking care of certain things and what letting go is to you? Like you mentioned about judgment and anger, taking care of them, letting go. I mean, that it's just a little sort of vague.
Yes,
of what
it is, because it's going to be different every time. And taking care of a baby, the crying baby. We have a friend, Mary and I have a friend, who has a one-year-old baby. And if the baby drops her toy or her pacifier, she immediately gets all screwed up and it starts to wail. And the mother just reaches down and grabs it, puts it back in her hand, says, "There, see, you're all right." Now, is this giving candy to the sweet candy to the baby? Well, it's the appropriate thing for the baby at that moment. So maybe there's times when we have to do something like that to convince ourselves that we're all right when we're all getting out of sorts. I don't know. But it is real easy to identify with an emotion, to think, I am angry now, and you made me angry. And if you are taking care of the anger, that puts a little distance from this hypothetical you and the emotion. You can be aware of it. In fact, you need to be aware of it. You need to feel it. But you need to watch out about acting on it, because you could do some damage. So, I mean, that has to be thought through carefully, what you're going to do with this anger. And it might be best most of the time to just sit with it, because it will dissipate. And then, as you're just sitting with it, watching it dissipate, then that's letting go.
Is it with the two-conscious anger, or the trusting the heart-mind section, where he says, indeed, not hating the world with senses is identical to true enlightenment? That sort of is what you're saying, that putting too much emphasis on the oneness.
I'm not sure that that's what that line is about, but it is in Trusting the Heart Mind.
Yeah, no, it's not about that in particular, but I remember Lord Lawson saying, not getting caught up in either one, everything's oneness. And I think Norm Crawford says, you don't want to be a damn fool thinking one with the car, or if you walk out in the middle of the road, no problem. That would be a problem for you.
Yeah.
Pretty quick. And then he says, too, don't get caught up in what you think things are. And I don't know, many things are said. Sometimes things are said like, things are not as they are, nor are they different than what they seem like they are. And so, it's just, what I take from it is just to try to keep going. Just try to not get stuck in whatever you feel stuck in. And that helps me when I'm feeling stuck in some troubling emotion about something. I do sometimes, maybe people think I do often, but I mean, sometimes I, like you, find myself acting on something and then thinking, well, that didn't go so well. Maybe next time something like that comes up, I should maybe try to do something different or whatever. But, I just think there's no way to get to a point where troubling things will not come up. There's no way to predict all the variables that can happen in this completely unfolding world. And I always loved when Steve talked about the fractal, where he had this thing where he showed a portion of a thing and it looked like there was a smooth surface, and then you zero in again and there's no smooth surface, and then it looks like there's a smooth part of it. No, there isn't. There's no irreducible core that we can get to where we've got completely to the bottom of everything. We've now got a blanket explanation for, going forward, from hence on forth, how to respond to everything that comes up. Because we can't predict what's going to happen. We just can't. It's like quicksand and it's horrible, but it's also bad. I think the practice helps me with that feeling of quicksand. That life is constantly unfolding the way it is. Anyway, just 2 cents there, my 2 cents.
Well, we're just up to 8:30. Yeah.
So, is there anything that's not thusness or suchness? Seems like sometimes.
A little bit later in that chapter that I was quoting, he addresses that.
What does he say?
I'll read it if you want to hear it. He's quoting Dogen again. We intrinsically have the countenance of the person of thusness, so need not be anxious about the essence of thusness. Because anxiety is itself the essence of thusness, it is not anxiety. Moreover, we need not be startled by the essence of thusness being this way. Even if thusness appears startling and suspicious, it is thusness all the same. There is that thusness by which you ought to be startled. It can't be measured by the measure of the Buddha or the measure of the mind any more than it can be measured by the measure of the Dharma world or the measure of the entire world. It is simply that one is already a person of thusness, so why should one be anxious about the essence of thusness? And then Mazumi says, isn't this wonderful? Your life cannot be measured by any restricted ruler. This reminds me of the koan by the sixth patriarch in the Nagaku Eho, which I have already referred to, who comes here as thus. Nangaku spent 8 years struggling with this koan. Who am I? Is a fundamental inquiry. You know the answer intellectually. I am the whole world. I am this obvious fact, the person of thusness, the essence of thusness. This is my life, your life. Nangaku said, if you try to explain it, it doesn't hit the mark. What is the mark? Where is it? You yourself are the mark, and you yourself are the bow and arrow. You yourself are everything. That is the target. How can the target be hit? Is there any kind of special bow and arrow? This wisdom that Buddha manifests is innate in all of us. It's the life of each of us. How do each of you appreciate this thusness? The unsurpassable way, as your life, as the life of the Buddha, as the wisdom of the Tathagata. It doesn't matter what you call it. How you take care of your anxiety, your frustration over this matter. If one wants to attain the essence of thusness, one must become a person of thusness. But one is already a person of thusness, so why should one be anxious about the essence of thusness?
Right. That's a good question.
Well, it's related to me, or it seems to me to be related to the question that drove Dogen to Japan when he was 20, 21, whatever, which is, if we're already Buddha, why do we need to practice?
That's a good question, too.
Why is it a good question? Because doesn't it presuppose that the Buddha didn't need to practice anymore? I don't think that's true at all. I would like to challenge that notion.
That's not a good question?
Well, no, I don't think it is a good question to say, well, if we're already Buddha, why do we need to practice? I know people ask that, but I can't understand.
That's what I said.
Okay.
That is the question that Dogen wanted to get answered, and that's why he went to Japan. To China. And what he came up with is practice realization. You do have to practice to realize it, to make it real. You have to do it. It's true already, but you have to do it.
What are we doing?
You have to practice. You have to practice you have to practice being here. You have to practice not being a small s self. You have to practice being the universe. You have to practice being a person of thusness. And how I define practicing being a person of thusness is watching my mind.
And watching the mind is,
and being aware of when I'm not being totally present without thought or preconceptions or biases or emotions or all of that stuff, you know, that the mind constantly throws up in response to whatever situations I find myself in, but are illusory. They're distractions. They keep me from seeing my connection with everything and everybody else.
So it's not making a problem of what's arising.
Yeah.
Or identifying with what's arising there.
What's arising is as it is. It's as it isness. It may look like a problem, but yeah, not making a problem of it. It's a good way to put it.
Appreciated your stories about work life. I found a lot that I identify different. I have a different work environment, but I just find a lot of times that when I decide to interject or try to fix a problem or put somebody in their place because I, you know, think they're attacking me or doing something wrong, that things would have been just fine if I just, you know, kept my mouth shut. And not necessarily that, not to say that you can't look out for what you think is important, but there's all this, you know, baggage that I find that I think I'm solving a problem, but I have to maintain this story then, and then of how I'm right and they're wrong, and I'm going to fix this issue, and then I have to carry around this idea of who I think that person is, and it's exhausting. It's just... And it's, you know, after a while you kind of like, oh, maybe just let that go. Do that. You know, there's that part of you that says, well, I can't let it go because then they're just going to, you know, walk all over me or take advantage of me or get their way or whatever. But if you notice, sometimes when I notice where that's coming from, it's just the release of that is it's nice to just let that go.
And when you can find a way to deal with a situation that isn't the direct confrontation, frequently that works out so much better.
I love the stories and some of the talks I remember about, maybe it's teachings or whatever, about not freezing people out. You know, I mean, like, I hang on for a long time to things that were said to me that I felt upset over what was said or what was done. And, you know, I mean, a lot of water has passed under the bridge, you know, since that time or whatever that was. Sometimes it's years later and I remember something. And I'm freezing that person out. That person is a dynamic, changing, you know, person. A million things have happened in that person's life since then. And maybe they don't even remember the thing that happened or whatever. And I'm upsetting myself by bringing that up. I'm the one who keeps bringing it up. And I have to, I'm interested in the examination, the backward step, and looking at why am I bringing that up? Because I'm upsetting myself by, you know, remembering whatever it is, like 10 years later or however many years it was. But, you know, I mean, it's not an easy practice, it isn't. I mean, but it's neither easy nor difficult, you know, as it's said in the teachings. I mean, it's just, we sometimes make it hard when it really isn't, and sometimes, you know, it's worse or whatever. But, I mean, let ourselves off the hook when we're not really doing the practice, and then we, you know, try to coast or whatever. But, anyway.
You're not alone.
Thank you. I sometimes feel like I am, so thank you for saying that. I know I'm not really. I mean, it's a feeling. Our feelings are not substantial. We forget that sometimes.
But they feel like they are.
It sure darn feels like it sometimes, doesn't it? It's really deceptive. It's really illusory, as David was saying. It really, truly is. And if we just wait a while, things dissipate. If we can just chill, or whatever the word is.
Well, we've almost made it to 45 minutes. Well, that was a nice, lively discussion. So thank you. Anything else? Well, I really appreciate all of you having made it today, given the weather. So, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.